It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we learn about the world of real-life Indiana Jones, archaeologists out to preserve the stories of history. First, the storm that's been brewing on Capitol Hill over immigration intensified this week, with President Obama announcing that he may use his executive powers to overhaul the U.S. immigration system and that he plans to do so before the end of the year. This is what he said yesterday during a press conference in Myanmar.
I indicated to Speaker Boehner several months ago that if, in fact, Congress failed to act, I would use all the lawful authority that I possess to try to make the system work better. And that's going to happen. That's going to happen before the end of the year. So they have the ability to fix the system. What they don't have the ability to do is to expect me to stand by with a broken system in perpetuity.
With me now is Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We heard President Obama there expressing frustration at Congress, accusing it of dragging its heels over immigration. What do we know about how serious the intent is of President Obama to use executive action at this point?
Oh, it's very serious. I mean, I think at this point what we're talking about is when he's going to announce it, not if. That's a big change from what we've seen over the course of the past year. He's talked about doing this for quite a while now. At first, he wanted to give Congress enough time to go ahead and try to pass their some version of an immigration bill. He said he was going to do this by the end of the summer, but then things got a little complicated. Some senators who were facing tough re-election battles, some Democratic senators, were pressing the White House to hold off. They thought it was going to do them more harm than good. And so this is finally, we've been waiting for this for a while, but it looks like it's finally going to happen.
Well, why now? Is he just trying to get it in before the end of the year?
Well, I think it's more a function that it's if he held out any longer at this point, I think immigration advocacy groups would just go crazy and wouldn't leave him alone. He's been kind of dragging his feet on this for a while. He's already delayed a self-imposed deadline from the summer, and I think at this point he's just saying, look, the Republicans are trying to get him to hold off and say, hey, no, we're going to try to do some things. We're going to try to pass some immigration legislation, and I think he's just kind of saying, enough is enough. I've waited long enough. I need to get this done. And he's made very clear that if Congress does get together and pass some sort of immigration bill, that he would be happy to sign it and that would supersede this executive order. But for now, I think he just feels that he has to get this done now.
Now, what is the timing on this? He's traveling at the moment. When could we expect an announcement on this at the earliest?
The earliest would be sometime next week. He's traveling. He doesn't get back till Sunday. And what they did in the last couple of days is there have been a couple of, you know, well-placed leaks about the basics of what this would look like, the sort of traditional D.C. trial balloon where they kind of float something out there to gauge a reaction. And they've gotten plenty of reaction to it in these last couple of days. So you have to assume they'll get back. They're going to take some time to tinker with things to gauge what the reaction was like, to see how far they can go in either direction. So next week, late next week is a possibility. And then, you know, anytime after that. He's going to do this before the end of this calendar year. So, you know, obviously doesn't have too much time left, but we could definitely see something next week.
So we've got this trial balloon, some unconfirmed details about what are likely to be in the plan. What do we know about what could be in the plan so far?
So far, so basically, the there's a lot of different components to what they're considering, changes to border security, changes to the legal immigration system, but really the big thing we're talking about is this plan to prevent any deportations against a certain portion of the undocumented immigrant population. Currently, there's about 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country. About 600,000 of those have already been protected under a previous order that he instituted a couple of years ago. These are mostly young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the country as children. And so what he's considering is expanding that pool of that sort of protected class of undocumented immigrants to anywhere up to 5 million. That's what we heard this week. That's, I think, what they were throwing out there. But I can tell you there's immediately after those details came out, a lot of the immigration groups came out saying, well, why 5 million? Why not 6? Why not 7? Why not 8? Why not 9? There's always going to be a component that they want him to stop all deportations, but I don't think that's realistic. So it's right now he's looking at about 3, 4, 5, and obviously he's getting pressed right now to increase that number a little bit more.
Well, let's talk about that question. So as long as the president is doing something that's pretty controversial with Congress right now, bypassing Republicans and you're doing something that's bound to inflame them. Why would he be conservative?
And that's a great question. I think if somebody put it to me yesterday, you know, the Republicans in Congress are going to get angry if he legalizes 100 undocumented immigrants. So why not do 9 million? And so that's definitely what they're pushing for. I think what he's trying to do is strike some kind of balance between doing whatever he does, if it's 1 million, if it's 2 million, that's already going to be an unprecedented historic move by a president to protect that many undocumented immigrants by himself. So it's the kind of thing where he's already taken this leap, and so why not go further? And I think the thought process is, if they just go all the way, if they go 9-10 million people, then that will make it absolutely impossible to do anything with Congress. I think this is sort of them trying to find a middle ground where, yeah, they're going to get a lot of flack from Republicans, but it's not so far that it's going to completely shut down the possibility of a legislative solution down the road.
Are the Republicans a unified bloc on this, or are there Republicans among Congress who would perhaps agree with this or at least be concerned about the Hispanic vote?
I think there is some disagreement as to how to react to this, but no, it's really hard to find a Republican right now that does not, that thinks Obama doing this is a good idea. Going all the way from the, you know, obviously the more conservative Tea Party Republicans out there are talking about impeachment. Some more moderate are talking about trying to figure out a way to stop this through the budgetary process and try to defund any of these moves that he tries to make. But even if you go all the way to the more moderate Republicans out there, I'll give you the example of Representative Mario Diaz-Balart. He's a Republican from Florida who's been one of the strongest proponents of an immigration solution that includes a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. He's been trying to draft a bill with a bipartisan group of members of the House over these last couple of years to try to find that solution. And even he, as he put it, was this would be the equivalent of throwing a hand grenade into the middle of Congress. So, I think there's a very unified front from the Republicans against this kind of move. The only difference among them is how to combat it.
There have been key Republicans who have been very critical of President Obama's use of executive actions over the past several years. What could the Republicans do to halt or blunt an executive order like this?
Well, I think and I kind of just touched on them a second ago. I mean, the most extreme, obviously, is the idea of an impeachment. But, you know, once you realize that you need 2/3 of the Senate to vote on that, that obviously becomes a quick impossibility. The only realistic option that I think they have. Oh, and I'm sorry. There's also been talk. Speaker Boehner has talked quite a bit over the last few months about bringing a lawsuit against the president for some of these executive actions, for this kind of thing, for including another order that the president did allowing the EPA to regulate carbon emissions from power plants. So they're working on that lawsuit strategy. But I think the most likely that you could see and the most practical is the idea of using the upcoming budget fights and the upcoming budget process to try to defund what he's trying to do. Understand, it's not he doesn't just say, hey, you 10 million people are illegal. There's a very complicated process that goes on. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is the organization that is responsible for accepting the applications, reading through them, figuring out who really does qualify. There's money for border security. There's a lot of components that require funding. And so with, you know, the federal government right now is only funded through December 11th, and so there's going to have to be some budgets passed in these next few weeks. So there's a lot of talk about using that budget and trying to figure out a way to ensure that he does not get the money he needs for these programs through that budget process. The big risk, of course, is if they send him a budget like that, he vetoes it, and all of a sudden we start talking about shutdowns and things like that. And so I think they're a little worried about that, but I think that's the only realistic option they have right now.
A lot of immigration groups, as you say, looking at what we know so far about what could be in the plan, Republicans looking at it, Democrats. What is your best guess about what kind of action we may see by the end of next week?
I mean, it's really tough to tell. I mean, these guys, if I've learned anything about this White House when it comes to immigration, is that it's impossible to read what's going on the outside from them. We can definitely assume that they're going to do something at this point. I think I've been hesitant to say that in the past because they've always kind of wobbled a little bit, but I think they're going to do something. I think it's going to include some improvements to border security. It's going to include some changes to the legal immigration system to allow businesses to bring in more workers with high-tech skills into the country. I think there's going to be those different kind of components. There's going to be some changes to how local law enforcement is allowed to help enforce immigration law. That's something that's been bothering the White House over the years. And then on this question of what population of undocumented, how many of them come, that's where we're all just kind of sitting here waiting to see. As we said, the sort of leaks that we've seen over the last couple of days indicate a population of about 3, 4, 5 million people that would target specifically undocumented immigrants who have children who are U.S. citizens. But just today, Vice President Biden was speaking at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, and he said something that they were going to focus on undocumented immigrants who have been living in the shadows for the longest. And that might indicate that they're looking at not just whose kid, which undocumented immigrant has a U.S. citizen child, but somebody who's, say, been here 20, 30 years, has no children, but has been here for a very long time, and that would significantly increase the pool of undocumented immigrants that could qualify for this program. So I think that's the biggest thing that we're just waiting to see.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Veronica, thank you so much.
That was Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Our guest dives into the world of the scientists out to preserve the stories of history before they vanish. People may be a little bit like Indiana Jones.
I came here to save you.
Oh, yeah? And who's going to come to save you, Junior?
I told you.
Don't call me Junior.
Harrison Ford there as the iconic Indiana Jones. Marilyn Johnson joins us now. She's a journalist and the author of the new book, Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Marilyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To the people who do it, you say archaeology is seductive. These people sift through rubble, human remains, debris, often for careers that are not so solid. What is it that draws archaeologists to do it?
I think curiosity is the main driving force. They are driven by curiosity about what lies hidden, what kind of unfiltered history is buried underground or under the oceans.
Now, most people think of Indiana Jones when they think of archaeology, and it turns out he has actually inspired a great number of present-day archaeologists. But how much do the people out there doing the rough field work resemble that character?
Well, they walk like him. Many of them have hats like him, and in no other way do they resemble him. They don't do archaeology the way he did it, and they shouldn't do archaeology the way he did it. He would just grab the gold and run. They're not interested in the gold for the most part, and they certainly don't run. They're on their knees around a hole with little tools, brushing very carefully and keeping everything quite intact.
Now, you got your field training for archaeology on a Caribbean island. What was your first taste of archaeological fieldwork like?
It was like having bugs crawl over me and being afraid that the undergrowth was going to swallow me up. It was unbelievably hot and uncomfortable. I had tons of sunscreen on and long sleeves, and I was really dressed to be attacked by the tropics. And instead, I found what other people have told me about the experience of archaeology. You don't notice all those intensely uncomfortable things. It is, you lose yourself in that search.
It's an interesting journey for you. You did this actual fieldwork. You were also, I was interested to read, here in Wisconsin, trying to see if you could figure out where ancient effigy mounds were. And it wasn't so easy, you found out.
I had this wonderful book called Spirits of Earth, The Effigy Mound Landscape of Madison and the Four Lakes. And it just got me very excited, and I thought, well, the mounds, you know, this is one thing that I have not seen, and here it is at my fingertips. So I went out looking for mounds, and I had the guidebook in my hand. I was looking at the sign, and I could not see them. They're made out of dirt. You know, when they're covered with leaves, they look just like a mound of dirt. So it takes, some of these archaeological features are very subtle, And it takes someone with an archaeologist's eye to recognize that they were created landscapes, landscapes created by ancient people.
And someone told you once that once you really train your eye, you see the arrow points everywhere. You start to see things and other people don't. Did you ever get to that point?
I'm hapless. I'm sorry. I never really did get to that point. But I do notice a lot more than I used to. And I'm quite fascinated by people who look at the landscape and see not just what's there, but can imagine what it was like 10,000 years earlier, who can imagine what previous uses there might have been for that patch of land. I'm a collector of archaeologists, not an archaeologist myself, and I give the people who put those sharp tools in my hands a lot of credit.
It wasn't always that easy for you to forge connections with these archaeologists. They're gone a lot. They're out in places where you can't reach them, and they tend to be a little secretive, it turns out, about what it is they're working on and their sites. And one person you did work with was a Dr. Connolly. Can you tell us about her?
Yes, she's the most glamorous archaeologist that I came across. She has a screensaver on her computer that shows someone digging into the earth as if in an initial dig in archaeology, but the archaeologist has a high heel on. So it's like it's a great message that she puts forth. She's been digging on an island in the Mediterranean for over 20 years. It is an island that has no natural water source. It's like a raised tablet, about 3 football fields long, very arid, and full of all kinds of archaeology, including from the 1st century BC and the time of Cleopatra. And she's connected the Temple of Apollo that they have dug up on that island with Cleopatra's administration.
Wow. So what was it like being there, working on something, you know, watching her work on something so ancient?
Different insects. A very harsh sun. Not quite as humid as the Caribbean. It was like kneeling. I had to wear a bandana over my face because there was so much dust in the air. And I was working with students, undergraduates, who were very interested in archaeology and who were so much better than I was. It was sort of sad. I was always lagging behind them. And I did the, you know, terrible crime of actually breaking a piece of pottery as I was trying to dig it up. Mm. They forgave me, though.
Well, one of the surprising things, it turned out, was that the Department of Defense is a big stakeholder in preserving the cultural remains of war. How big is their role?
Well, it's huge, actually. And it's not just the Department of Defense, including all the military installations in the United States, the federal parks, and all kinds of federal institutions have laws in place where they are not just concerned that anything new that is built on that area doesn't disturb archaeology, doesn't disturb our archaeological heritage, but they actually want archaeologists in place with a plan for how we can preserve the cultural heritage of that area. So there is a group of archaeologists that I met who are in place at Fort Drum, New York, and who are in charge of the archaeology of the whole area and don't just save Indian ruins here and remnants of the 1930s barracks there. They also are trying to train soldiers to be culturally sensitive when they go to, for instance, the old world of Iraq. Train them so they can recognize indications of archaeological sites.
Now, briefly, Marilyn, having lived and worked alongside archaeologists for a while, how has that changed the way that you perceive time and the people who came before us?
Well, I didn't quite realize how much we don't know. I had no idea. I read a history book and I get the sense that, you know, this or that might have been contested, but it seems pretty much written in stone. And when you start working with archaeologists who are picking up fragments of the historic puzzle, many of which they have absolutely no idea what they are for or how a particular structure got built or why it was built, you come to realize that the past is really a sort of wilderness. It's a very adventurous place to be right now. And the headlines show that. You read in the headlines about the future of medicine and the future of space and, oh my goodness, we just put something on a comet. But really, there's a lot of news about the past and how we learn to interpret it in a different way.
Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
That was Marilyn Johnson, the author of Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. It's time for Food Friday. Today we're not so much taking a look at a single food, but rather a flavor. According to our next guest, it's one that's traditionally been snubbed in North American cuisine, but with the rise of things like IPA beer, dark chocolate, and greens like arugula and radicchio, the flavor of bitter is maybe finally having its moment. And our guest makes the case that a touch of bitter can breathe new and exciting life into your cooking. Jennifer McLaughlin joins us now. She is a chef, food writer, and author who's written several books. Her newest is called Bitter, A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor with Recipes. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, so right off the start, let's get a definition for bitter, because it turned out to be a lot harder to pin down than you thought.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I thought, you know, it would be pretty straightforward, but it's a difficult flavor or taste to pin down, because I think it's so variable. You know, we can all agree what's like sweet or salty, but we all have different ideas on what is bitter. It can range from something like a celery leaf, which is mildly bitter, right through to something that is, you know, really bitter, like an espresso coffee.
So as an epitome of bitter, you went all the way back to your childhood. You looked at a white grapefruit that you used to eat. What was it about that grapefruit that just really captured bitter?
Yeah, it's
bitter?
Like, I talk to some people, and of course they don't even remember white grapefruit because the pink and the red ones are so popular now. But there was something special about the white grapefruit. It did have more of a bitter chemical in it, which means that it was actually a lot better for your health. And it was just that kind of bitterness. It was like you needed a touch of sugar to counterbalance it. And that's a very strong memory from my childhood. So that was kind of, I was talking to a friend saying, you know, how that white grapefruit have totally disappeared and how everything seems to be getting sweeter and sweeter in our lives. All the food seems to be getting sweeter. Sugar is added to everything. It's kind of time to bring bitterness back, because if you take bitterness out of your cooking, you really lose something.
It seems as though, at least in the United States, we've kind of gotten to the point where, you know, bitter is a flavor that in the past we've avoided. Bitter is bad. It's sort of the thing that has been burned onto the bottom or that makes you pucker in some way. And it's not a flavor that we seek out in our cooking. Why should we reconsider bitter right now?
I think we should consider bitter because you can have bitter in a dish without it being, you know, tongue-curlingly, horribly bitter that you want to spit it out. I think bitter adds dimension and depth to a dish. So, you know, my favorite example to give people is something like caramel. And, of course, you know, everyone says, well, no, caramel is sweet. And, yeah, that's true. But when you make caramel, which is made by cooking sugar until it caramelizes, you need to take it to a point just before it burn. So it just has like all these different chemical compounds. And then you make a caramel that is so much less sweet and so much more complex and interesting to eat. So I think that's what bitterness does. You know, adding a few bitter greens to a salad makes it so much more interesting than just something that's made with Boston lettuce.
Right, and you make the case that bitter is a great balancer, because if you get all the dimensions in perfect harmony, that is beautiful cooking, and I imagine bitter can play a key role in that.
Yeah, and bitter is, you know, it's a perfect match for fat, one of my favorite things to talk about, too, but If you have a very rich dish, say like a duck breast or something, and you serve that with some bitter greens or some broccoli rabe or something, what bitterness does, it really helps your digestive juices. So it really helps you digest the fat and make you feel so much better. So it's a very good balancer for a lot of things.
Well, let's talk about some of those greens you were mentioning, the bitter greens that you think really make a dish extraordinary. And some of them were radicchio and frise and lots of these arugula, these new greens we've seen picking up popularity in the United States. What do you like about them and how do you use them?
I like them a lot, and I think they're becoming popular because you see them a lot in salad mixes that you can buy in the supermarket. You know, radicchio is great because it has that wonderful red color, and it's great to add to a salad, but it's also really great to, like, grill or sauté because that balance adds out its bitterness a little bit. And, you know, if you grill it and then serve it with something like a creamy blue cheese or a creamy goat's cheese, I love that combination.
That does sound good. Well, what are some...
And also something like, you know, dandelion greens, which you see sometimes in the supermarket, you balance that with like a rich, fatty bacon dressing where you cook the bacon and then you put that in with the greens, the bitter greens, and then you take the fat from the cooked bacon and you make a dressing with that. That's just a fabulous combination.
Okay, you're selling us on it here. What are some other introductory bitter foods? If someone is intrigued by this bitter idea, how can they start gently?
A good way to start is with a salad. So you can make your regular salad that you might make with like a Boston lettuce or different kinds of sweeter lettuces, and then just throw in a few of these greens or put in some like Belgian endive leaves or put in some radicchio, put in a few celery leaves. You know, celery is a very underrated vegetable and most people just throw the leaves away. Those leaves are really pleasantly bitter. So take out a few of the Boston leaves and replace them with these bitter greens, and you'll see that the salad is so much more interesting to eat. And then I think after a few times, you really want to just take the Boston lettuce right out and just make a whole mixture of bitter greens.
Well, chicory is another example that you write about in your book, and it's also a fascinating story of chicory coffee and how it found its way to Louisiana. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, chicory was added to chicory. We always think of the green part, but in some parts of the world, especially in Germany, it was grown for the root. You know, coffee was quite expensive, and it got more expensive in places like Louisiana when there was blockades during the Revolutionary Wars and all that. So people would grind up other things. They would roast different kinds of things from, like, nuts and everything, but they would roast the chicory root to make coffee, and then and they'd add it to the coffee beans, or they'd just make a kind of coffee. It wasn't really coffee at all, but they'd make a kind of coffee with a roasted root. And people grew, especially in Louisiana, grew actually to like this chicory coffee. And anyone who's been to Louisiana has been to the cafe where you have the chicory coffee, and it's totally a different taste.
And is that, you know, the bitterness of that, is that why it goes so well with beignets?
Yeah, well, that's why, you know, I mean, coffee is bitter. You know, we kind of forget about coffee being bitter today because we've grown so used to the taste, and we put milk and we put everything else in, so that mitigates its bitterness. But, yeah, as soon as you roast something, you caramelize something, you almost burn it, you play up those bitter flavors. Like, one of my other favorite things is, like, toast. You know, people make toast, but if you make toast properly, you get like those wonderful burnt edges, and they're kind of the best part to eat because there's a little bit of bitterness in them. And so when you put like jam on your toast, the sweetness of the jam and the bitterness of the burnt edges is just like a perfect combination.
As we get older, do we naturally or physiologically, do we come to like bitter more, be more accepting than we do as children?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, most kids don't like bitter tastes, and as children, we have more taste buds on our tongue, and so we're much more sensitive to bitterness. And also, there's an innate rejection of bitterness because it can signal a toxin or a poison, and that's very dangerous when we're like a baby or a child because just a small amount would kill us. But as we grow older, We lose taste buds, so things that we thought were extremely bitter when we were kids are not nearly as bitter to eat. And also we learn that things like caffeine are not going to kill us, actually stimulate our nervous system, and we actually learn to like them, and we learn to crave these bitter tastes. So I kind of think of bitter as being a very adult taste. It's something that older people enjoy much more than younger people.
And you've been kind enough to give us a recipe, radicchio and pumpkin risotto. Can you talk us through that one? How does bitter come into play?
Well, I think that's a really good combination because, you know, I mean, I call it pumpkin. You probably call it squash. But, you know, it's a sweet flavor, the squash. So the bitterness of the radicchio matches that, the sweetness of the squash, and so it balances it out. And it's also a very pretty combination because you've got the orange pumpkin or squash in with the risotto and then the purple leaves of the radicchio. So, and then you put some fat on there with the Parmesan cheese, and it's just a really, really good combination and perfect for this time of the year when there's pumpkin everywhere.
I never thought I would crave bitter things, but I'm starting to talking to you. Is this something that you actively crave now that you've really...
I think I've always craved bitter. And, you know, think about chocolate. Now, you know, we probably all start off with a very sweet chocolate, but once, you know, I think it's a good way for people to get used to bitterness because almost everybody loves chocolate. And you go to the supermarket and buy your regular chocolate bar and then go and buy some of those more expensive chocolate bars that are like, you know, they start at 65 and they go to 70, 84, and some even go up to like 90% cocoa beans. And you'll move from that sweetness through into the bitterness, and you'll find that you just need one square of that more bitter chocolate to be very satisfying. And it's much more interesting. You'll actually taste not the sugar anymore, but you'll taste the flavors of the chocolate, like the dried fruits and the different nuances there are in the chocolate once you take the sugar away.
We're talking right now with the author and chef Jennifer McLagan about all things bitter. She's the author of the book Bitter, A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor with Recipes. And speaking of recipes, we have one up for you, the radicchio and pumpkin risotto that we were just talking about. That recipe is up on the Central Time Facebook page right now. And we'd love to hear from you. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you feel about bitter as a flavor? Do you crave it, as our guest Jennifer McLagan does? And what bitter foods do you like to cook with? What questions do you have about how to use it, how to experiment with it, and to bring out other flavors in food using bitter? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. We're talking with chef and author Jennifer McLagan. She's taking us on a culinary tour of the flavor bitter, why some of us love it, some of us can't stand it, but how to use it now and bring out the best in our cooking. She thinks bitter is having a moment. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. What about you as an adult? Have you grown to appreciate bitter beer, for instance, IPAs? Do you crave that flavor? What about that dark, dark chocolate without the high sugar content? Is that something you feel that you have become increasingly fond of, maybe as you get older, or maybe we're just moving in that direction? And how do you use that bitter flavor in your cooking? 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Take our first caller now. Casey joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Casey.
Hi. I was calling to see if you would consider salt to be a bitter taste, as you define it. It has some of those same properties of cutting through fat, you know, that you had mentioned bitter has.
Gotcha. Thanks, Casey. Salt, is that sometimes a bitter component?
I would call salt its own taste. Like, you know, I put it like you think of sweet and sour and salty and bitter and umami, or that savory taste. I think what you will find with salt is if you add salt to something that's bitter, you'll probably reduce its bitterness. Salt is a way of like masking bitterness. So if you put some like that's like a salty ham with something that's bitter, it will counteract the bitterness. I wouldn't call salt itself bitter. You might be thinking of something like, often you'll think of like sodas or some kind of sparkling mineral waters. They can be bitter, and they can also be salty as well. There's a lot of confusion about what bitter is, and the thing is, it's very hard to define, and what you'll find it and think of as bitter might not be bitter to me. Everyone has their own, like, variation of bitterness.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Casey, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think is bitter having a moment? Is this something that you crave, maybe in beer, in chocolate, in those greens, arugula, radicchio, frisée, that are a little more bitter as well? And Jennifer, you experiment with some interesting things, some interesting ingredients, and one of these is tobacco. You even have a recipe for chocolate tobacco truffles. How does that work?
Yeah, I was kind of I was interested, you know, because there's all these molecular chefs now who are doing all those weird tastes, and they play around with tobacco as well, which, of course, is bitter. And if you ingest tobacco, it's not the same effect as smoking. I'd like to say that straight up, and there's a tiny amount of tobacco. But what's really interesting in the truffles that are flavored, they're infused with a little bit of cigar, so they have this kind of bitterness that hits you at the very end. So you have this little chocolate truffle that's kind of bitter because it's rolled in cocoa. Cocoa's very bitter. Then you get the sweet chocolate richness and creaminess. And then just as you swallow the end of the truffle, there are actually receptors in the back of your throat that pick up bitterness. And you'll just get this little kind of bitter kind of hiccup in the back of your throat. And it's the same thing you'll get if you swallow a spoonful of olive oil. If you have very good quality olive oil at home, you should just take a spoonful and swallow it completely. And you'll probably want to cough because there's little receptors at the back of your throat. So it's just kind of a little curiosity kind of thing I did.
Yeah, a little science there that you can test at home with olive oil. Well, let's take another phone call. Lisa joins us next in Viroqua. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a special ed teacher, and I have students that have exceptional sensory needs, and I often meet those needs using sour candies. I'm wondering what the distinction between sour and bitter is.
That's a very interesting one because a lot of people confuse them. And actually, sourness or acidity is only comes from acids, but it still gives you sometimes that negative reaction where you, if you have one of those very sour candies, you want to spit it out because it's so sour. But only acids will give you that, whereas bitterness comes from like over thousands of different chemicals. So bitterness comes from a whole lot of other different sources. But it was interesting when I was working on the book, I asked a lot of people and people said to me things like rhubarb, that's bitter. But actually it isn't, it's sour. So they're very close because they're often negative tastes, but they are different.
Okay, well, thank you much for that, Lisa. And on to Rocky in Neshkoro. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, Dawn.
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Well, you were talking about bitter things and the different tastes and stuff. In my drinking days, I used to like brandy old fashions. And then I got really hooked on brandy old fashioned sweets. And to make a brandy old fashioned sweet, you have to add bitters. Have you ever tried it?
Bitters. Okay, yeah, let's get into that. That's an interesting one. What about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you can buy bitters in a bottle, which is often Angostura bitters. Probably everyone has a bottle in the back of their cabinet, and that's something that's quite bitter that's added to cocktails. And I think there is a trend today into making cocktails with bitters. There's a lot of people making bitters from everything, from like rhubarb through to lemons and limes. And I'm hoping that cocktail that interest in those bitter cocktails will translate into the kitchen. So people who like cocktails that aren't super sweet anymore will think about, oh, maybe I should cook something that has a little bit of bitterness in it as well.
Well, I want to dovetail a little bit into beer now because, you know, beer brewing has uh-huh. been around for ages, but the rise of hops as a brewing ingredient has led to this big craft brewery beer boom, you know, pairing beers and the flavor bitter. How did that come to be?
It's interesting because, you know, beer was originally made without hops, and then hops were added for the bitterness, and also they discovered that there's a chemical in hops that works as a preservative, so it helps keep the beer, it helps make the beer last longer. And, you know, now everyone is making beers of different amounts of bitterness. They're growing special hops in different regions, and they're flavoring the beer with it. And beer is kind of, you know, everyone cooks with wine. They always add, like, wine to something or an alcohol. But beer is pretty interesting to cook with as well. So if you're making any kind of, even something like a beef stew, which you probably might add some red wine to, you should try adding beer, because the beer will work exactly like the wine, but it'll add a depth and a bitterness, and it'll cut through the richness of the beef stew. So it's a really, really interesting liquid to cook with.
And Jennifer, in our last seconds, are there other bitter ingredients that you find now you can't live without and that we should try?
Oh, there's lots, but I really think that the frise is a good one to like. The lettuces are really good ones to start, and turnip is another thing that I think I like turnip all the way from turnip, and I'm learning to love rutabaga. I don't love that as much because it's too bitter for me, but my husband loves it a lot, so I cook it. So I think you should not try masking these vegetables that are bitter with, like, sugar. You should try and match them with, like, fat or salt, or balance them out with other ingredients. And just embrace bitter. Just add a little bit to your cooking, and then you'll find that you can take a little bit more. It's a taste you need to learn to love.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Veronica.
That was Jennifer McGlagan, the author of Bitter, A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor with Recipes. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. News is coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.